one of the what happens to you when you become an apologist is your life, you just have books, and you have to carry them around all over the place, and well, I suppose nowadays you get these tablets that you can put things on. So now I'm going to do this is the comedy act before the lecture. We'll put that there, and we will balance some of these books on here. I hope you don't mind. I haven't pinched these things from the bookstore there, but I see you've got a running library here with some excellent books, which I'm going to appeal to in this talk and also recommend to you for those of you who are wanting to get started in on this journey of loving God with all of your mind. All right. Okay. Well, this is the last part of the run this weekend, and thank you for being here this evening. It's been a good weekend, and thank you for being so gracious to us, and I hope that you ladies are blessed with my wife. As you've probably discovered, she's the brains in the outfit, and she's a very gifted teacher, and you know, I've taught in a number of countries in the world and in a number of places, and I've learned that to be humbled by that, because at after events, I've had people approach me and say, "Simon, could you speak to Nell and ask her to see if she'd be, if she could send me her notes?" Nobody asks for my notes. They want my wife's PowerPoints. They want her notes. Nobody asks me for my stuff. So that's certainly been very humbling. So hopefully you ladies are blessed with that talk. That opening clip was one of my favorite YouTube videos. Hopefully you enjoyed that. All right, so the talk this evening is a critique of Darwinian evolution and naturalism. And this is also a first for me on this topic. So hopefully this will pan out somewhat well. And I have this gentleman at the back here helping me with my PowerPoint. And that isn't always successful, but hopefully we'll make some headway. All right. We've all had childhood memories. We all remember some events in my early childhood when we were impacted by a certain event or a trip you went on, and certain things that just stick with us for our lives. And I had one such event happen to me when I was a young man. I went on this to this youth camp in South Africa, and we were doing Bible study and that kind of thing. And during this Bible study, the guy who was leading it, we got into, who raised the question of philosophy or whatever the case is. This is when I was a teenager at high school. But I remember this guy saying these words. He said, "Philosophy is man's vain attempt to reach God." I mean, why would we inject something else into the system of Christian thought in order to know God? Can we just read the scriptures and get God's word undiluted and free from the vain and feeble thoughts of men? And behind this statement, philosophy is man's vain attempt to reach God, and other statements like these, which come in a variety of stripes, lies a disparaging or unfavorable attitude, which continues to be held by many Christians towards philosophy. And I mentioned this in my talk earlier this morning. And so in short, this attitude says that towards philosophy is, philosophy has got no place in the house of God. Philosophy is a godless activity done without the superintendence of the Holy Spirit, or is it incompatible with the ministry of the Holy Spirit, and therefore philosophy has no home in the company of those who believe in Jesus Christ and His gospel. Why should Christians think that Aristotle or Plato or any other pagan philosopher, ancient or modern, should have anything to contribute to the Word of God? I mean, this is the kind of sentiment that you've got going on. Well, later on, as I grew up, I continued to believe that that's what, you know, what philosophy was about. And it just seemed to be further backed by this first verse, which is used by many Christians to say, yes, you see what it says? See what the scripture says? It says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends upon human tradition and the basic principles of this world, rather than on Christ." Some Colossians 2:8. So there I had it. I had not only these ideas from people in my church, but the Bible seemed to suggest that we needed to abandon philosophy. Well, I now have changed my opinion on that, and I certainly think that that interpretation of that verse, and we'll get to dealing with that, is not necessarily the case, but we will attend to that later on. So what then is philosophy? Definition of philosophy. The reason why I'm talking about this is because in this talk this evening, I'm going to address a philosophy. It's called naturalism. And we're going to see how we're going to use a good philosophy to combat a bad philosophy. So philosophy has two aspects, a way of thinking and a body of knowledge. Philosophy is the act of human beings reflecting or thinking upon the nature of our world and our experience of this world and attempting to give an account of this experience. And philosophy is often interested in examining the things which we often take for granted. Significantly, philosophy is that school of thought which is often interested in the presuppositions that people believe in. A presupposition is an idea which serves as a starting point for a larger view or opinion on a subject. And this assumption or idea may form the basis or a principle by which another discipline might embark on its study. And so for this reason, it's very important to understand that philosophy is critical. Indeed, every single academic field has some philosophy which comes first. Like I said, there's a prolegomena. There's something that comes first to theology. There's a prolegomena to the science. There's a philosophy of science. There's a philosophy of mathematics. There's a philosophy of history. There's a philosophy to everything. So philosophy is to be found in every department. And generally, it concerns itself with the basic assumptions that people have when they start doing their scholarly work. Again, you might be wondering why I'm talking so much about philosophy, and the reason why I'm going to do this is you're going to see that we're going to critique two false ideas, and one is naturalism, and which is really the philosophy that lies behind Darwinian evolution, for the most part. And we can also realize that one cannot critique philosophy without employing philosophy. Just like folks who try to deny logic have to use logic in order to deny logic. Okay, so that position is basically self-defeating. Okay, we could ask, for example, something like with respect to logic. Logics are what we call, they are things that cannot be demonstrated. They cannot be proven in the way that I can give you an argument for them. They are what we call are the axioms of thought. Okay, they are self-evident to us. Okay, they are principles of being, the law of identity. A is A. The table is the table. It is something that is just a part of the existence of things, and so we cannot argue for that. You just see it. I can't argue that 1 + 1 = 2 is. When I show you what 1 + 1, when you see what 2 is, you get it. It's intuitive. Okay, and when people try and deny the laws of logic, they have to use the law of logic in order to deny the laws of logic, thereby establishing how primary they are to thinking. Okay? And so, for example, you hear this in apologetics. People say, well, I don't use Western logic. I use Eastern logic. Okay? Because they try and make a distinction between different kinds of logic. There is no such thing as Eastern and Western logic. There is just logic. Okay? And when Eastern religions try and do that, okay, where they say that they can affirm the law of non-contradiction in their system, they end up actually using the laws of logic. Okay? And so they're inconsistent, and you can point this out with them. And with respect to philosophy, this is sort of like philosophy. If I said to you, well, I don't care too much for philosophy, I can say, well, suppose that's your philosophy about philosophy then. That is, you don't care too much about philosophy. So you can sort of see how it works then. You can't escape it. It's sort of like breathing oxygen. You know, everybody's doing this at some level. We're thinking about, once you start thinking about the nature of reality and reflecting upon things, you're doing philosophy at some level. It's the same with the laws of logic. You don't need to teach this to the kids because it's part of the fabric of reality. You know, when I say to the kid, you know, I want you to eat the Brussels sprout and not the chocolate, okay? They know the distinction between the two because they know the law of identity applies. A is A. The Brussels sprout is not the chocolate. And I'm not going to confuse the two. But I desire the chocolate and not the Brussels sprout. You see? And kids get this, okay? So this is just a part of the nature of reality and how we think about things. And this is always the challenge to try and talk to philosophy to people who haven't read it, because a lot of philosophy can become very abstract. But I don't want you to become discouraged by that, because hopefully we'll see this is just a part of, there's levels at which philosophy is done. There's a kind of philosophy which is done at universities and by professors with PhDs that can be desperately boring, okay? I know, because I have to read some of that stuff, okay? But then there's just popular level philosophy which is going on all the time. Like when the person says, oh, there's no absolute truth. And then your response is to say, is that absolutely true? Because it's a philosophical statement about the nature of truth, that there is no absolute truth. So you can see this is happening in the culture. So everybody's doing this kind of stuff. All right. Now, in order to buttress my case for philosophy, maybe I haven't persuaded you yet, but let me appeal to two good authorities worth thinking about. Let's just read this quote here, and slide 3 and 4. From C.S. Lewis, okay, and I quoted the last half of this verse, but it's important for us to, I think, read the first half of this verse. It says there, to be ignorant and simple now, not to be able to meet the enemies on their own ground, would be to throw down our weapons and to betray our uneducated brethren who have under God no defense but us against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy must be answered. This is C.S. Lewis. He understood the importance of philosophy. So many people love C.S. Lewis. So many professors at evangelical institutions love C.S. Lewis and all of his wonderful works. He's one of the most gifted writers. But what's sad to me is they don't seem to pay attention to this issue, because a lot of these people are disparaging of philosophy. I wish they would listen to what Lewis is saying here. More than that, I think C.S. Lewis is an apologist, because he says there's those of us that if we don't take up the mantle of being defenders of the faith, we're not going to be able to meet the attacks of the heathen. We're just throwing our weapons on the ground. And there's people in the church who don't know how to deal with the intellectual onslaughts. They haven't had the time to learn, or they haven't been fortunate enough to have been blessed with the teaching. And so it's for those of us who've been given this task to stand between them. And so when Richard Dawkins and these atheists get amongst the university students and they start accusing them of being stupid and foolish and, you know, ignorant and all this, I'm going to step in there and do something about that and say that, no, that's false. And I'm saying to young Christians, you don't have to buy that. There's no basis for that accusation. C.S. Lewis was not only a good philosopher, but he understood apologetics. It's very explicit in this statement from him, which I think comes from The Weight of Glory, his book, The Weight of Glory. The next slide is Dr. Norman Geisler, who's sort of like the grandfather of apologetics in modern America at the moment. A lot of people who have written these books were all former students of Dr. Norman Geisler, who founded the seminary I study at. And he said this in an article he wrote for the Evangelical Philosophical Society a number of years ago, and I think it is 100% correct. He said this about the Christian academic institutions. He said, unless either philosophers become biblical exegetes in our schools, or those we now call biblical exegetes take to the pursuit of philosophy seriously and adequately, and there is a conjunction of these two things, biblical exegesis and philosophical intelligence, there can be no cessation of theological troubles for our schools, nor I fancy for the Christian church either. Sure, that is, Dr. Geis has written a lot of stuff and I've read a fair amount of it. This is one of the very best quotes that he's ever penned in my estimation. He nails this on the head. It's not enough to just know the scriptures in the age in which we live, where the Bible is under attack. You certainly need to know the scriptures, and perhaps more so now than ever in the past, because you're going to need to know the Word of God in this life. But you need to understand also the ideas behind the heathen and their attacks upon our faith, and not be intimidated by what governs their worldview, and know how that system works. And so I see this sort of going on in Paul in the book of Romans, when he is writing his letter to Romans. He annoys me at times, because he's on this fabulous book and he just sort of interrupts himself and then just takes these little detours, because as he's making his arguments, he's Jewish and he's mindful that the letter of Romans is written to a congregation that has Jews and Gentiles, and he's mindful of the Jewish mind and how it's going to work. And the moment he's making an argument and he becomes aware that there's going to be a Jewish objection, he takes a little detour and he responds to that. He cuts that Jewish mind off before it can get to the objection. Once you understand that, then Romans becomes like, wow, I know, you can see this. And so when you read the book of Romans, Paul was a Jew of Jews. He understood the objections that the Jews had, and he would cut that objection off before it even arrived at the door. It's brilliant. I mean, Romans is just such a magnificent book. I mean, it's wonderful to discover these things and to see these things. And so too should we, when we're going out to speak to skeptics and people who are naturalists. I can anticipate what their objection is going to be, because I know how that philosophy works. And so I can combat that bad philosophy with a good philosophy. Now let us move on to, now that I've ranted on a bit about philosophy, I've done that because I want you to be enthusiastic about this, and it's going to help you. And more specifically, as we move on to the philosophy of naturalism, we're going to need these tools as we get into this discussion. Then, when philosophers are discussing ideas, they for the most part attach to the end of the idea three letters, ISM. Okay, so you get materialism, or natural, or nature with an ism on it, naturalism. Okay, and I'm going to begin first with a critique of naturalism. The chief reason is this is the chief philosophy which undergirds Darwinian evolution. Naturalism is a species of philosophy, and so if we're to offer a critique of naturalism, we also first need to define what we mean by naturalism. What we have here is the concept of nature wedded to an ism, okay? And so the question is, what does naturalism mean? We need to know this before we critique it, because we don't want to have a straw man. That is a false view of the idea we're critiquing. Okay? So here are some definitions which I found to be quite helpful. William Dembski, in an article critiquing naturalism, had some helpful things to say and gives us a useful definition. He says this: naturalism has become the default position for all serious inquiry, from the humanities to the natural sciences to biblical studies to the arts. Inquiry is allowed to proceed only on the supposition of naturalism, the view that nature is self-sufficient. Naturalism is not atheism. To affirm that nature is self-sufficient is not to deny God's existence. God, after all, could have created a world to be self-sufficient. Nonetheless, in the interest of keeping human inquiry productive, naturalism insists that the existence and activity of God be bracketed. Naturalism affirms not so much that God does not exist, as that God need not exist. And because God need not exist, intellectual honesty demands that we get about the serious work of life, invoking Him. So what he's saying here is naturalism doesn't mean atheism. Okay, you can't have naturalists, okay, who are not necessarily atheists. Okay. So there's a variety of stripes of naturalism, okay? So people who are pantheists, okay? That is people who believe that, this is like a lot of the Eastern religions are pantheistic. They believe, who's seen the movie Avatar? Okay. And so what do those guys do when those guys are driving their bulldozers through the forest and everything is going pear-shaped and they're all in a quandary and they're shooting their bows and arrows and it's all very creative? And they're in a quandary. They go to this big tree, hey? And they take those ponytail things of theirs, and what do? They plug them into the ground, into this tree, and they connect with the earth because they see themselves as all being one with the earth. There's a pantheistic worldview behind Avatar. Okay? No concept of transcendence. Nothing transcends the universe. All there is nature. That's the Eastern religions. Many of the Eastern religions advance that kind of idea. All is nature and nature is God. But the kind of naturalism, which is going to be of interest to us this evening, is that the kind of naturalism we tend to find in Western culture is a kind of naturalism that weds itself to science. Okay? And here again, Dembski is quite useful. He says this: naturalism comes in a variety of forms. Its principal form in Western culture is known as scientific naturalism. Scientific naturalism locates the self-sufficiency of nature in the undirected natural causes studied by science. Accordingly, scientific naturalism would have us understand the universe entirely in terms of such causes. In particular, since human beings are a part of the universe, who we are and what we do must ultimately be understood in naturalistic terms. This is not to deny our humanity, but it is to interpret our humanity as a consequence of brute material processes that were not consciously aiming at us. Nor is this to deny God, but it is to affirm that God exists, that if God exists, he is marvelously adept at covering his tracks and giving no empirical evidence for ever interacting within the world. To be sure, it remains logically impossible for the scientific naturalist to affirm God's existence. But only by making God a superfluous rider atop a self-contained account of the world. Okay, key part of that paragraph from Dembski there is the understanding that all there is nature, and what explains reality and what's true is done through the sciences, because the sciences are the disciplines which explore and investigate nature. So if we want to know something is true, which department do we go to? We go to the science department to get truth, because that's the discipline which studies nature. Scientific naturalism. Okay? And so there's no kind of God directing anything. There's no kind of God connected with it. If he did, he's basically almost this deistic kind of a being. This is the kind of naturalism, scientific naturalism, which you find governs a lot of the universities of this country and certainly the worldviews of many in the United States. And elsewhere, for that matter. I mean, certainly in Europe, this is also true in Europe. So when dealing with naturalism, or when dealing with people, there's a variety of ways that we can respond to a given questions. And so sometimes when we're engaging somebody in our evangelism and they raise an objection, we might be able to offer a theological response. Okay? Sometimes this is called biblical apologetics. If a person has a question about a specific passage and they read it, and you say, well, hang on a sec, I think you've just taken that verse out of context. If you just read a little bit further on, I think this helps clarify that particular issue. And so you've done some kind of biblical apologetics there. Or you offer a theological response. People say, well, you know, God, this will be more sort of philosophical theology. Well, you believe God made everything. Yes. So you believe that there's evil. Yes. Okay, so you believe God created evil then. Well, no. That's the question that comes up, and you would have that sort of doing philosophical theology. I mean, there would be a response. We can discuss that maybe in the Q&A session, okay? But sometimes we have a theological response combined with a philosophical response. For example, in my attempts to share the gospel with my aunt, who's very much swallowed a lot of liberal ideas, and she says this: we shouldn't judge people. Okay, who of you have heard that? Okay, which verse do they appeal to? This probably is the most appealed to verse at the moment in the world. Matthew 7:1. Do not judge or you too will be judged. Now we can offer two responses. We can offer a theological response. So what would our theological response be? What are they doing with that verse? Taking it out of context. Read on. Jesus is saying, don't judge. He says, don't pass certain kinds of judgment. Okay? So I corrected my aunt. I said, look, you're appealing to this verse. This is what the passage actually says. But I didn't leave it there. Because then I went on to offer, in conjunction with my theological response, a philosophical response. And I said to, aside from that fact that this is not what I think the Bible says about judgment, that philosophy that says that we shouldn't pass judgments, is itself a bad philosophy. It's a self-defeating philosophy. Because if I say to somebody, you shouldn't judge anybody, what have I just done? I've passed a judgment. So I said, that philosophy is self-defeating. So I've offered two responses to her, okay? Sometimes when we come up against a philosophy, we don't necessarily need to appeal to a theological response. Sometimes we can just go after the philosophy and offer a philosophical response. I just want to see what that. So, okay, so this is where our culture is today, as sad as it is. This is at Speaker's Corner in London. Now, before I took this photo, there was a bunch of people listening to this guy. That sign says, "Don't believe anyone, including me." Okay? Here's a guy in a public arena standing up saying, holding a sign, said, "Don't believe anyone, including me." And there were 20 people listening to this chap. So I walked on over and I said, "What are you people doing?" I said, he doesn't even believe that. And they said, no, we want to hear what he has to say. I said, no, you don't. Oh my gosh. Mental constipation of the highest order. This is the kind of stuff you get going on at universities. Now, what I'm saying to you, sometimes when I'm talking about philosophy, you're going, gee, this is getting really... Look, this is the culture. This is in Europe. This is how people think today. It's bad philosophy, and it says what it says. We just need to offer what? A better philosophy. And we have a philosophy to offer them that is built upon the principles of Christ and His revelation to us. And so sometimes when we come to the question of naturalism, when you're speaking to a skeptic, it is unlikely that he's going to say, well, now that you've told me that my ideas are incompatible with the Bible and my naturalism doesn't comport with the Bible, I guess I'm actually going to give up on my naturalism. Is that what people say? Well, you know, your view is inconsistent with the Scriptures, so I guess you're going to have to abandon that idea and come and join us. What? Does evangelism work like that? No, it doesn't. I'm not trying to dismiss or make light of the Word of God, because I can tell you now, you will bump into people who don't care about this stuff. And what they need is the gospel. And you better be ready to be clear on what it is to give it to people. Not every conversation demands an apologetic. I don't want you to get that idea there. But sometimes, and often, and ever increasing, you're going to have to answer objections that people have. So sometimes what we can do when we examine the claims of naturalism, we can see if it is a philosophy that corresponds with reality. Remember our view on our definition of truth. Truth is that which corresponds with reality. Does this philosophy correspond with reality? Is this philosophy coherent? Okay. Does this philosophy give an account for certain things which we know to be the case? Because if it cannot do those things for us, then we can say that this philosophy is false. And so there are a number of critiques that we can offer against naturalism. Again, naturalism is the view that nature is all that there is, and nature has the capacity to explain all of our questions. Science and scientism is often connected with naturalism. So what do we mean by scientism? Scientism is the view that science answers all the questions. Another ism that you'll find thrown in, which is closely related to things, is materialism. Okay? This is what might help us distinguish, say, for example, your naturalist in the West from a naturalist in the East. The kinds of naturalists we have here are more, they believe in physicalism or materialism. They believe all there is matter. There's no transcendent thing in the world. There's no immaterial dimension to the world. Okay? And so often you'll find that when people talk about naturalism, be mindful of the fact that scientism is hanging and lurking in the shadows there, and materialism is something else that will often be thrown in. These isms are often this little trinity of bad ideas hangs together. Okay? So be aware of that. What is materialism? We can think of matter and or material, things which are physical and have physical effects. And so when you bump into a bunch of people who believe all there is material things in this world, you find yourself amongst a bunch of materialists. Okay? All right. So, it is easy to see how these things are, these scientism, materialism, naturalism are all connected. And it is also easy to see how these things are going to be at odds with the Christian faith. Because Christianity doesn't say that all there is nature. With respect to materialism, Christianity asserts that there is also a spiritual and therefore a non-material dimension to the world. God is spirit. The human soul is not material. So as a Christian, you cannot buy into materialism as a philosophy. With respect to scientism, Christians also hold that there are some ideas which can be known which fall outside of the boundaries of science. Jesus atoning for your sins is something which cannot be proven scientifically. We take Jesus' atonement for our sins on the basis of the authority of the Scriptures. I can't give you a metaphysical reason for why Jesus' blood atones for my sins. But I'm grateful that God tells me it does. There's lots of things like this about the faith that we take on the basis of the authority of Scriptures. And that's not irrational. Because it's a good authority to trust in. Just like when you go and study engineering at an engineering institution and the civil engineer who's got a PhD says, don't design things this way. It's not irrational for you to think, look, my professor said I shouldn't do that because he has experience building these structures. Well, I'm going to try this experiment and build this reinforced concrete structure and use this design that these guys say doesn't work. Oh, there the building comes collapsing down now. Well, I should have paid attention. You see how this works. So this notion that Christians, oh, you just subject yourself to this authority without... Most of what people know comes on the basis of some authority. When the fireman comes to your house, okay, to give you a lecture on fire, and he says, look, when you have a fire in the kitchen in the oil pan, don't throw water on it. Where do you go? What do you know? You know, I've got a fire, here's a bucket of water. No. Look, this guy has an authority on what? Fire. You don't say, that's just foolishness. That just serves to make my point now. It doesn't mean we can't think about the nature of the authority or give thought to that. It doesn't mean we don't do that. We still do that. But it's not. There's nothing irrational with putting your confidence in an authority. It's a very important point to understand for Christians, though, because we're bullied a lot on this front, okay? Particularly in the area of the scientific disciplines. With respect to naturalism, Christians believe that there are two things that exist. One group of things that is created. Everything that we come into interact with our world is contingent. That is, it's dependent upon its existence from another thing. And so there's two things that exist. Contingent things and one non-contingent thing. That is God. There are things that are dependent. And there's one thing that is not dependent, that one thing that is a necessary being that always has existed. Okay? If this exists, then when people say all there is nature, they're wrong. Because what they're saying is all there is one kind of thing. And there are two kinds of things. There's created things and things in nature, and then there's the creator of those things. And so we can see how Christianity is going to be at odds with materialism, scientism, and naturalism. And so these are three isms that we're going to have to, three philosophies in some sense, that we're going to have to combat and fight against. To refute materialism, scientism, and naturalism. All right. What advantage is there for you and I in this kind of a discussion? Well, here's the advantage. When you are speaking to people, you will sometimes bump into people who have done like a master's degree in biology, or they've done some kind of study in this discipline or that discipline, or this, you know, engineering degree or that engineering degree. And so it's very easy to get intimidated, and you don't want to trespass and presuming to know more than a guy about astronomy when he has, for example, a doctorate in that discipline. You can certainly ask him good questions. But the reason why I say this is when it doesn't matter what discipline you find experts in. All of them have some or other philosophy going on behind their study. And what you need to dig down to is some of these basic assumptions. And you can ask very good questions at that level. And that can be done very effectively by anybody. Why would you begin with this assumption about the nature of reality? What makes you think that all there is material in the universe? You can ask that question of a guy with a PhD, because he's assuming materialism. So why materialism? Why should I? You know, that's a great question to ask somebody, for example. So to help you see this at work now, I'm going to give you a great clip. This is one of the best clips that I know of a very effective Christian scholar engaging somebody who is a naturalist and holds to scientism. So let's just watch this this clip here.
Taken together with a reason why people believe, desperate to believe, together with the fact that you don't need actually a God, in a sense amounts to an argument against the existence of God.
Well, I guess I don't see that. I mean, why doesn't that commit the genetic fallacy of trying to say that by explaining how a belief originates, you thereby show the belief to be false? Even if it were true that belief in the existence of God were the product of fear and anxiety and so forth, which I don't for a minute admit, but even if it were, that's simply a genetic fallacy to say that because that's the way the belief originates,
that's only one
that therefore half. The belief is false.
But that's only one half of the argument. I'm not saying that that alone is adequate, and I'm not saying that the fact that science can account for everything it alone is also adequate. But taken together, the fact that science is omnipotent, and the fact that I can understand why people like you desperately want to believe in God. That is an argument against the existence of God.
But two fallacious arguments put together don't make a sound argument, right?
They are. But do you deny that science cannot account for everything?
Yes, I do deny that science.
So what can't it account for?
Well, had you brought that up in the debate, I had a number of examples that I was going to give. I think there are a good number of things that cannot be scientifically proven, but that we're all rational to accept. Let me list five. Logical and mathematical truths cannot be proven by science. Science presupposes logic and math, so that to try to prove them by science would be arguing in a circle. Metaphysical truths, like there are other minds other than my own, or that the external world is real, or that the past was not created 5 minutes ago with an appearance of age, are rational beliefs that cannot be scientifically proven. Ethical beliefs about statements of value are not accessible by the scientific method. You can't show by science whether the Nazi scientists in the camps did anything evil as opposed to the scientists in Western democracies. Aesthetic judgments, number four, cannot be accessed by the scientific method because the beautiful, like the good, cannot be scientifically proven. And finally, most remarkably, would be science itself. Science cannot be justified by the scientific method. Science is permeated with unprovable assumptions. For example, in the special theory of relativity, the whole theory hinges on the assumption that the speed of light is constant in a one-way direction between any two points A and B. But that strictly cannot be proven. We simply have to assume that in order to hold to the theory.
But you're missing the whole
point. So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah. Okay.
So, okay. Okay. Great clip, hey? Dr. William Lane Craig, he's on our team. Imagine if we could have a lot more men like him at the universities teaching the Christian faith to people. That clip is so good, okay, and you're going to watch it again, though, because it's very packed. But this is real life, defending the faith going on now. This is a leading a skeptic from the United Kingdom, Peter Atkins, okay? Now, what did you catch there? What did he say about science? Science is omnipotent. Scientism, okay? And we know what is closely allied with that is what? Naturalism, this view that all that nature and science account for everything, okay? Yeah, we see this philosophy at work. These are the kinds of ideas which many scholars in the university hold. even if they aren't in philosophy departments, many of the science departments hold to this view. It's worth us listening to the view again. Pay careful attention now to how he responds. Okay, and see if we can remember some of the things that Dr. Craig says are legitimate things that science cannot account for. Listen carefully. Run that clip again. And notice how he points out the fallacies as well.
The reason why people believe, desperate to believe, together with the fact that you don't need actually a God, in a sense amounts to an argument against the existence of God.
Well, I guess I don't see that. I mean, why doesn't that commit the genetic fallacy of trying to say that by explaining how a belief originates, you thereby show the belief to be false? Even if it were true that belief in the existence of God were the product of fear and anxiety and so forth, which I don't for a minute admit, but even if it were, that's simply a genetic fallacy to say that because that's the way the belief originates, that therefore the belief is false.
But that's only one half of the argument. I'm not saying that that alone is adequate, and I'm not saying that the fact that science can account for everything it alone is also adequate, but taken together, the fact that that science is omnipotent, and the fact that I can understand why people like you desperately want to believe in God, that is an argument against the existence of God.
But two fallacious arguments put together don't make a sound argument, right?
But do you deny that science cannot account for everything?
Yes, I do deny that science.
So what can't it account for?
Well, had you brought that up in the debate, I had a number of examples that I was going to give. I think there are a good number of things that cannot be scientifically proven, but that we're all rational to accept. Let me list five. Logical and mathematical truths cannot be proven by science. Science presupposes logic and math, so that to try to prove them by science would be arguing in a circle. Metaphysical truths, like there are other minds other than my own, or that the external world is real, or that the past was not created 5 minutes ago with an appearance of age, are rational beliefs that cannot be scientifically proven. Ethical beliefs about statements of value are not accessible by the scientific method. You can't show by science whether the Nazi scientists in the camps did anything evil as opposed to the scientists in Western democracies. Aesthetic judgments, number four, cannot be accessed by the scientific method because the beautiful, like the good, cannot be scientifically proven. And finally, most remarkably, would be science itself. Science cannot be justified by the scientific method. Science is permeated with unprovable assumptions. For example, in the special theory of relativity, the whole theory hinges on the assumption that the speed of light is constant in a one-way direction between any two points A and B. But that strictly cannot be proven. We simply have to assume that in order to hold to the theory.
But you're missing the whole
point. So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, okay.
So okay. None of these beliefs can be scientific.
Okay, so there we see the apologist in action. We see the Christian engaging the secular thinker in a debate. And we need more of that kind of stuff going on in the universities. Wouldn't it be amazing if a church like this or some churches in Pennsylvania could get together and sponsor a guy like Dr. Craig to come up and speak at Penn State or Dr. John Lennox or maybe do a series there. And this stuff is beginning to happen in other parts of the country. I've been involved with these kinds of initiatives at Clemson University and at other universities where churches are trying to make an impact in there, and we can put our guys in there to go and challenge some of these things, challenge scientism and naturalism. And if you notice in Dr. Craig's response, there's a few things that he mentions that were response. Key amongst them is what? It's the fact that science itself cannot justify how it works. Science presupposes certain things, okay, and in order to begin its task. It depends upon mathematics and logic. Well, science can't demonstrate those disciplines. It presupposes mathematics and logic. Okay, science has nothing to say to ethical issues, for example, nor has science much to say about the aesthetics, what is beautiful, what is good, what is true. Okay, so this is just a great clip for you to remember and like I said, to see how this sort of stuff is working in action. And as we do this, I want to remind you of this particular verse here. Well, I mentioned this earlier on today. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. I believe what we've just watched is precisely that kind of thing going on. taking an idea that's false and bringing it down, showing where it fails. That's exactly what we do. And I think we need to have spiritual warfare isn't necessarily this, you know, nebulous demons hiding behind every bush. What Dr. Craig is engaging in there is genuine spiritual warfare. What we're up against in a large part of this part of the country is skepticism. We're combating skepticism. It's a philosophy. It's an idea that we're struggling against. As I've said previously, we can offer a number of critiques against naturalism, and I don't want to, like I said, there's entire books, like for example this one here, which has got multiple articles written from a number of scholars critiquing naturalism on a whole slew of different fronts. But certainly, we're not going to have time to get into those discussions, and so I want to try and give you a few that are perhaps more accessible, because some of these things get very abstract. And even I can't follow some of it. I have to read those articles multiple times before I get my own mind around it. Or I have to ask my wife to explain it to me, is usually what I end up having to do. Some of the things that we can address. One of the questions we might ask ourselves is the question concerning knowledge itself. Okay, is knowledge material? Is human knowledge material? Okay. When we look at, for example, the question of triangles, okay? When I say to you triangle, what do you have in your head? You have a triangle, okay? But is that triangle that you have in your head related to any particular triangle in experience? Okay, if I said to you, okay, look at the triangle on the wall, okay? You would have a particular instance of a triangle, okay? So this is the question philosophy dealt with, is the problem of the fact that we've got many particular things in our experience, and then we also, our mind has the capacity to turn things into universals, okay? To abstract universals from some things. So for example, we don't confuse, if I said to you, take the chairs outside, okay? Well, what do you do? Do you pick up the chair and then that speaker over there? And then the table? No, because you know that there are some things in this room, okay, that we would group because they have the same nature, okay, and this generates within our mind a concept of a chair, okay. So our minds have the capacity to do this, to group things based on a similarity between particular things. So when I say triangle, what comes into your mind is a triangle, okay, which didn't originate from anything out there. Okay? So this is a question that philosophers are wrestling with in terms of how it is that we get, when we talk about knowledge, okay, when I come to know, for example, the table doesn't come into my head physically. Because if it did, I would have a big piece of wood stuck in my head and I'd be dead. It wouldn't be much use to anybody. But human nature, we've been endowed with faculties which can allows data to come to us. And then we have concepts in our head. And then our minds have the capacity to arrange and organize those concepts and to put them into categories. And so this is one thing I don't think that naturalism can account for. Because these things, I think, are immaterial. Okay? Triangleness, dogness, tree-ness. If I said to you tree, okay, you have a concept of a tree in your mind. But if I said, go and cut down the tree, the pine tree in the front of the, then you might go outside and see that there's a particular pine tree over there. But pine trees would share their nature with other trees. And so hopefully that makes some sort of sense to you, because we're doing this all the time. You know, we're grouping things in our experience and we're forming what they call our universals. Okay. Key, naturalism cannot account for morality. That's what Dr. Craig said. Can the scientist tell me that I ought not to stab my friend in the back? No, he can tell me why my friend is now dead, that when you put a 6-inch blade between the back of a guy's shoulders into his heart, that it's not good for him. Okay? And he can tell you that if you do that on many occasions, it's going to lead to the same results, because the physiology says when you put something into the pump, which is the heart, then this is what happens to people. He can get into great detail, extreme detail over the how it happens and why it happens. But he can't comment onto you why I ought not do it. This is the distinction between the fact-valued dichotomy. Because we're not just saying, okay, when we say you shouldn't murder somebody, when we're considering a murder, there's a physical act, okay? But then there's also a moral dimension to that physical act. It's an ethical thing going on there. And if all there is physicalism and material, then on what basis do they have to say that you ought not to do this? This leads to another problem for them, as Dr. Craig pointed out. On what basis then, if you assume this worldview, can you then say that something is wrong? Because if we are just material things dancing to our DNA, chemicals in motion, then I'm not really culpable for putting the knife in my brother's back. That's just physics work at work. It's just chemistry at work. So on the basis of a materialistic, naturalistic worldview, how do you have any kind of system of justice which demands that people ought to do this? Where does that come from? This isn't a material kind of thing. So your scientific worldview cannot account for that. If you have this strict physicalism, which is what so many people have today. Now imagine that, and this is what's odd about it, is so many of our leading scholars in the academy hold to this philosophy. And yet, when they go out, how do they conduct themselves? As if we ought not to do things. Do they go home and just shoot their wives because they're annoyed with them? No, because they know that you ought not do that. Well, where does that come from? From their physicalist worldview. And even if they did do it, if they're consistent, what should we say? Well, just I guess it's his physics, man. Bad chemicals, I suppose. But even saying bad presupposes some kind of value judgment. So I want to be consistent with that worldview. Can you see the problem with this worldview? Further, what about the concept of free will? If we are just chemicals in motion, can we say that there's any kind of thing such as free will? Where I have a choice? It seems like that just goes out the window as well. You don't make choices. Your chemicals just erupt and you just follow those chemicals along the way. The concept of free will would be related to the morality question. So now you can see this worldview working itself out. But I can guarantee you that man, Mr. Atkins, doesn't live according to that worldview. And so in terms of his worldview doesn't correspond with how things are. He cannot account for these things. And secondly, it's not coherent. He has a view of science which doesn't comport with his view on ethics. These things are inconsistent. And even worse, he doesn't even live by his own worldview. He's pinching from another worldview. He's pinching an ethical system from another worldview. In that kind of worldview, there are no criminals. In fact, the person who murders the other person is as much a victim as the guy, who is murdered. Because he's just doing that because the chemicals reacted, and that particular chemical event led to the death of this chap, and this particular chemical event was that this guy put the knife in this chap's back. And is he culpable of anything? No, it's just... So you can see how, on the front end, this view of naturalism and scientism just pervasively takes over the academy. But as we begin to scratch and dig and ask a few questions, we begin to see that there's immediately a number of significant problems with this view of naturalism. Does that help a bit? Okay, so these would be the kinds of questions that you might study with your young students before you send them off to universities, is grapple with naturalism and give them a couple of ways to answer naturalism. And there's many other arguments we can make against naturalism, but I don't want to overwhelm you with those. And some of them are quite sophisticated, so I'd have to speak to my philosophy friends at the seminary and say, look, explain that argument to me again. I need to... Yeah, this is what I'm at seminary. I'm privileged to be at the seminary because I had to hang around all these really smart people. I've got this friend of mine who's got cerebral palsy. He's this guy in a wheelchair. He's 24 years old. This kid has got an amazing mind. I took him to Cambridge to present a lecture in a room that was... There were 25 people in the room, and I was the only one who didn't have a doctorate. And this young American kid just gets grilled by these PhDs. And this brilliant young kid just... This Christian kid is just answering these questions. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if we could train up a generation of young people who love the Lord, because this kid loves the Lord and can think like this, and put them in the academy, in the universities to contend for the faith, man, that would get interesting. And there might be young people in this congregation here who have that same gift, that we could equip and train to go out there and to go into Penn State and to contend for the faith, and in the way that Dr. Craig has done this, so that that kind of conversation happens in Starbucks with some skeptical 21-year-old. Hey? That would be wonderful. Okay, now that we've spanked naturalism, or we've said enough about it, and we've offered a critique, the next part of the talk was to do a critique against Darwinian evolution. Okay? Now, I did naturalism first because often the philosophy behind Darwinian evolution is naturalism or scientism or materialism. Those isms are the three little brothers, bad brothers, that hang out together. And they're often under the Darwinianist kind of thinking. Not always, because remember, we learned this morning that you do have theistic evolutionists. Guys who are theists who also believe in evolution. So do bear that in mind. Okay, now what's happened in the whole Darwinian discussion? Okay. Well, in my estimation, the debate has changed in recent decades. When I was first introduced to the discussion, there would be a lot of discussions between creationists and evolutionists. And so the evolutionists would offer up certain paradigm examples of how evolutionary theory happened. So there would be the Galapagos Islands and Charles Darwin's early Origin of Species writings, and they would point to things like the peppered moth experiments, and they would point to certain transitional forms, and they would point to, for example, the amount of DNA that is shared between, say, for example, ourselves and chimpanzees, and say these are all common. Then they would point to the physiology and our anatomy and show how, you know, the skeletal structure of the seal looks like the whale, which looks like Uncle Jimmy, and so, you know, Uncle Jimmy was, you know. And you've heard all of this kind of stuff. And then they would go into anthropology and they'd dig up some guy with a big forehead and say, you know, this is a Piltdown man and he was from here. And the creationists would get in and they would get involved in these discussions. And the pepper moths experiment was proven to be this. And some of these arguments from anthropology were proved to be hoaxes and just really bad science. But of course, the evolutionists are just clutching and really desiring to find something to substantiate their view. And the creationists did a great job of challenging it. And Jonathan Wells wrote a great book called The Icons of Evolution, in which he refutes many of these very well-known evolutionary examples, which continue to be used in our schools today. And these things have been dismantled, and they still teach them. And what happens, unfortunately, what happens in high schools is like 15, 20 years behind where the science really is. Evolutionists have given up on the arguments that schools... So high school teachers who are teaching evolution are using, you know. So this is what's going on. And then so you had the creationists coming and they were taking on the anthropologists and pointing out a number of things. So they would mention things, for example, like the Cambrian explosion. This notion that we all began in a prebiotic soup and then gradually evolved into more complex beings. That's nonsense, because what do you have? You have some things, and then suddenly in a geologic chart, you just find this explosion of life. The tree didn't go like it, just went and then... You know, how does that happen in your system? You know, the Cambrian explosion is a problem for them. You know, Stephen Meyer recently wrote another excellent book on that particular issue. We even would point out things like the fact that people, very famous evolutionists, would look at the fossil record and go, man, I don't find transitional forms here. What I find is stasis. That is, things don't change. They stay the same. And so he challenged sort of dogmatic Darwinian gradualism with his punctuated equilibrium theories. And so this was a part of the discussion, and it was back and forth, and there was some great responses coming and a real challenge on that front. They would point to, for example, catastrophic events. This young earth creationist did some great work in this area with showing that what we find isn't this sort of nice ambient environment where everything can just survive. What we find is catastrophe, massive flooding, meteorites hitting, and that doesn't help the Darwinian solution, because what they need is long periods of time with, you know, creatures in a lot, growing number, changing and turning into different things. And what we have is mass extinction and this kind of thing, which works against the theory. All of that has been part and parcel of the discussion, and some of you who've been involved in this might have heard of these arguments, and they're still around there. But in my analysis, the debate has moved from that down to a more primary question. The key questions that have been asked today, where the debate, where the heart of the debate is now taking place, is the question regarding abiogenesis. How is it that life comes from non-life? The other important argument that's come in, and this was introduced by a guy by the name of Michael Behe, who wrote a significant landmark book called Darwin's Black Box, is the question of irreducible complexity, and we'll get to explaining it. And the third was information systems. I think that this is where the debate on Darwinian evolution has moved towards. Well, let's talk first about abiogenesis. What is the problem here? Well, the problem is a problem because of Louis Pasteur, okay? Because previously, in ancient times, people believed that life could come from non-life. You know, if you left a piece of steak out there for long enough, then sooner or later, suddenly there'd be flies coming out of the meat. So people assumed that life could come from non-life. And then they started investigating these things, and they realized, well, hang on, there's actually flies come and lay little eggs there, and these maggots go in, and then they would take meat, and then they would put it out of the domain of that, and it still, stuff happened to it, and so they were trying to explain that, and their view of life was very simple, that life could come from non-life. And then Louis Pasteur comes along and basically shows them that when you have a sterile environment, you cannot get life coming from it. The entire evolutionary project depends upon that scientific law being violated. Because prior to life, there was no life. There was a sterile environment. This is still an excellent question to ask, the question of abiogenesis. Now, the evolutionists attempted to do some experience to see how they could assemble and organize and perhaps, you know, if we got enough chemicals and enough lightning and the right kinds of temperature in some prebiotic soup, then voila, zap, and suddenly these things would organize themselves and you'd have a cell, and then that cell would go through the selection process, and before you know it, you've got Mozart writing a symphony. Okay, that's what they argued. And so some significant people, as early as 1924, Alexander Oparin, who was a Russian scholar, did some work on arguing for a purely materialistic approach to life. And he had some contributions from a British scholar in 1928, a guy by the name of J.B.S. Haldane. And they laid down a theory of chemical evolution, that is, chemicals becoming a living thing. Then there was the Miller-Urey experiment here in the U.S. where these two chaps put up some test tubes, and they ran some stuff through these things, and they produced some kind of a tar or some kind of sludge, and where they had monkeyed with some chemicals to produce and show that, you know, what we have here are at least the basic chemicals for life. Okay? But of course, what's particularly unpersuasive about that whole thesis is that simply saying that we've got the protein molecules and these things there for life to begin is a long way from having a cell. What's compounded the problem in recent times is the advancements in microbiology. And what we have now discovered is that the cell isn't some sort of basic protoplasm. Every single cell inside every living thing is immensely complex. And every single cell has within it an information system and a copying system. And this has thrown a spanner in the works, or a wrench in the works, as they might say here in the US, for this notion, for two reasons. First, this is why Michael Behe's book on irreducible complexity is so important. This is a microbiologist who will be speaking at our conference this year, by the way. And if you want to read a great book, do read it. It's called Darwin's Black Box. He says, look, you can't keep on going back and going back and going back and going back and saying, because at some stage, the most basic cell has to have a number of components all functioning at the same time. It's like he uses a rat trap as an analogy. It's got a base, it's got a spring, it's got a hook to put the cheese and a catch. You can't have one of those things missing and it works. All of them have to be working at the same time in order for this thing to catch a mouse. Likewise with the cell. You can't have just the membrane floating around in a prebiotic soup and going, oh, there's a mitochondria. I'll just scoop that in here, thank you very much, and I'll reach out there and... Can you see? But remember, Darwinian evolution doesn't have any kind of teleology. There's nothing directing. It's just chance. And the mathematical probability of that happening, of chemicals organizing themselves into this kind of thing, is impossible. It's completely improbable. This is where the debate has shifted to now. This is the question that we need to press home with these people, as far as I'm concerned. To make matters even worse, not only are the irreducibly complex systems present a formidable challenge to Darwinian evolution, but the information systems in biology are just the most powerful in my imagination. Okay? Because not only do we have these amazingly complex systems, but we have an information system. Okay? Now, what's cool about this argument is it's going to do two things for me. It's going to show a refutation of Darwinian evolution, but it's also going to show a refutation of naturalism. So, is there a pen? Does somebody have a pen handy for me? Thank you very much. Okay, so I was discussing this with Dr. John Lennox, who, by the way, this book on God and science, in my estimation, is the best introductory level book on God and science out there. It's called God's Undertaker: Has Science Buried God? Very accessible. Just a brilliant book, really worth reading. He's also written an outstanding book on the age of the earth called 7 Days to Divide the World, which, if you're interested in that, is also worth reading as well. Okay, so information systems in biology. And here's the argument that Dr. Lennox shared with me. He was at a fancy dinner in Oxford. They get together and talk, and he had to sit next to this guy who was a microbiologist. And when this guy found out that Dr. Lennox was a mathematician, he thought to himself, well, geez, this is going to be a really boring evening. I'm sitting next to a mathematician. And Dr. Lennox said, well, you know, hopefully, you know, it won't be that bad. We'll, you know, I love to talk, and I'm interested in other things. And so he said, I'm interested in the status of the universe. And they got into this discussion. And they got into Dr. Lennox, in a masterful way of doing evangelism to this other professor, starts talking to him about information systems and biology. And here's basically how it works. He had a menu there which said roast chicken on it. And he was saying to the guy, how is it, what explains roast chicken? Does the ink and the paper explain it, or does something else explain roast chicken? Well, of course it does. We know a mind is responsible for putting on the menu roast chicken. So suppose I've got two bits of paper here. This is how I explain it. I think it helps to make sense. Simon. Okay, so we've got two bits of paper here. Okay. All right. Right. Now, materially, they're exactly the same. Okay. Same amount of paper, and let's just say that there's the same amount of ink, black ink on both. But there's a third thing there. Where is it? There's another thing there. Where is it? Which page is it on? What is that? Information. But what explains it? The paper and the ink? No, because it's the same as it is here. Materialism is false. See how powerful that argument is? We could teach kids in the university how to show people how that works. Information. You didn't think that. You think that comes from just nature? No, because information comes from a mind. So here's the question he asked this guy. He says, why is it that when you look at that roast, that menu, and it says roast chicken on your menu there, you infer upwards and you think that there's a mind. But when you look into your cell and you see an information system, 3.5 million or billion letters long, you don't infer upwards, you infer downwards. Isn't that inconsistent? And this guy was just so taken back by this argument. He says, you know, I've been studying this in my laboratories for 30 years. He says, it cannot be demonstrated. And now we have arrived in the age of information. And what have we found in our biological systems? Information. Because you could capture information with any material thing. I could arrange these chairs in a way to communicate information. So it doesn't matter that it's proteins, you know. But when you have information, you have mind. And human beings don't account for the information systems in living things. So the question is, where on earth does it come from? How powerful is that argument? That, in my estimation, is where the debate has moved to today. And it's interesting to see what's been published at the moment. A very significant book has recently been published by a guy by the name of Thomas Nagel, who's a leading professor at NYU, which is an emeritus professor of philosophy. NYU is a top philosophy program in the country. Okay? This guy is not a Christian. He's an atheist at the top philosophy program in this country. He's published a book recently called Mind and Cosmos, Why the Neo-Darwinian Paradigm is Almost Certainly False. This is coming from an atheist who's saying, he says, look, the Darwinian theory is a theory that is in crisis because it cannot account for all these things, and he lists them. Amongst them is the issue, the question of mind and ethics and information systems in biology. And he's calling for some kind of move. And yet the Darwinians are holding on to their theory, but there's just more anomalies just mounting that they cannot include, they cannot account for. And so as Christians, we're in a position now to press them. If we would own the arguments and understand them, understand what Darwinianism is claiming, and then see what we're discovering in the sciences as scientists, and taking the arguments and ideas and going into the academy and to the culture with these things, to talk about how reasonable it is to believe that God exists. Why? Because the heavens declare the glory of God, and every single cell in the universe has an information system that declares what? There is a mind behind it. It's very powerful. I think this is a key argument that we have at our disposal now. And for the sake of this thing, it does two things. It argues, number one, against materialism, as I showed you there, and it argues against Darwinian naturalism. And that's the end of my talk this evening. So now, if there's any time left, I'll perhaps take a few questions. And hopefully that's been of some help to you then. You can see I've got daughters. I found this thing in my pocket. This is a plastic princess crown from one of my daughter's dolls. I thought, what is it in my pocket there? That's really annoying me. Oh, that's what that is. See? Did that help? Did that help make sense? You know what's so cool about this stuff? Is when you study it, you just realize how amazing God is. He's just awesome. And I am so grateful that people like Dr. William Lane Craig and Dr. Lennox are on our team. I would just wish that we can get them into the universities on a more consistent basis to engage the skeptics. Not so that we can just give an answer, or give a reason for our faith. But when young Christians see these guys at work in the university, it encourages them. There's a very important verse in Acts chapter 18. Typically when talking about projects, people refer to Acts 17 and other verses. But there's this instance of this guy called Apollos, okay, who's teaching, and Priscilla and Aquila come to him and they help clear up. He needed some more instruction. And then he goes out, now equipped with this knowledge, and he goes and he helps some other believers who are struggling with the Jews. And it says that he refutes them in public debate. And what else does it say? He's an encouragement to those believers. Apologetics isn't just to answer the skeptic. Apologetics is there to encourage you, to show you that you have reasons for what you believe, but to also show to you that there's a way for us to go out and communicate to these skeptics. Because it's all God's creation. We just got to think about it and know, say, look, this is pointing us towards Him. And show them where this is. And show them where they're inconsistent when they look at these things and they arrive at the wrong conclusions. Any questions? Yes, abiogenesis. Yeah. 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 That, right to the point. I remember being at Clemson University and we're doing evangelism after Rabbi Zacharias had spoken. And these guys would come out and we had tables set up to answer questions. And of course, all these guys come storming, all the skeptics come out there, come to the tables. This is the God and Science table. And we're trying to do evangelism. It's great stuff, exciting stuff. And I got these three guys coming in there and, you know, they're, you know, first year university, second year, you know, they're really like, oh, just educated and sophisticated and, you know, stroking their chins. And, yeah, I was in church. Yeah, been there, down there, bought the T-shirts. Yeah, you people basically believe in really stupid things. I mean, dead man rising, you know, that kind of. So anyway, I said, you know, these things would be really absurd in your world. Yeah, supernaturalism doesn't make any sense in that worldview. I said to him, but I, it's not crazy in my worldview. Miracles are possible because I believe in a supernatural God. I said to him, but I just want to let you know that if you think that we believe in some things that are crazy, I said to him, you have some things that you have to believe in your worldview, which demand an even more bizarre kind of a belief because you don't have any grounds for justifying it. And I raised this question. I said to him, here's two things you have to believe. Number one, you have to believe that the universe came from nothing. Okay? Because he said the universe can explain its own existence. Well, cosmology tells us what? That the universe came into existence. Okay, so you have to believe the universe comes from nothing. That's more difficult than me to say, well, I've got a dead body here and it rises from the dead because I've got an agency which can explain it. I don't have an answer. It's just that you don't buy my explanation. I said, number two, you also have to believe that Louis Pasteur was wrong because you need to believe that in order to get your project off the ground, that life comes from non-life. Well, who's doing the science now? And this is the question I asked him. You studied this stuff. And so they came in with so much sort of pride and hubris, and I was able to just come alongside and just take a pin and just, you know, when you take a balloon and you put the pin in right close to the top, it doesn't burst. It just goes down. That's what sort of happened. And then the conversation changed the nature. Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. Because they came out of there, you know, bold as you like, you know. But look, these things aren't difficult. Our kids, we teach our kids this, Pastor, teach them to use those laws. Say to them, hang on a sec, who's doing the science now? Teach them to use that. Say to them, you need to talk to your high school friends about this. Isn't this inconsistent? We learn this law and then we're told when we come into classes in evolution, well, for the moment, we need to abandon that idea. Well, hang on a sec. I have a question, you know. Yeah, excellent. Carry on, sir. Yes. Yes. Yeah. 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 To get more and more disordered. Not as evolution says, systems tend toward disorder. You know, if you leave a house in a field, it eventually caves in and breaks down. You know? Or evolution demands that what? You have the opposite going on. It starts with and moves to more complexes. So yeah, there's many, but we've got to start teaching this to our kids, and this becomes a part of your training as a Christian, so that we can then go in and talk to people in a persuasive manner about this. Thanks very much. What else would you expect from a veterinarian, you know? Yes. I love that. That's what we need. We need more guys out there. I mean, this is a gentleman who works with God's creation every day, and we need people talking about these kinds of things. Yes, ma'am. Okay, good question. Okay, so for the children, there are a number of good resources out there. I'm going to be sending Doran a list here of recommended readings for that. For the kids, Dr. William Lane Craig has actually done a very basic series, like kids' books for kids, teaching them some of these things. Okay? And he's also got a very good introductory level apologetics thing called Reasonable Faith. Answers in Genesis has got some great material for young people. Okay? There's a number of ministries now that are beginning to see NEFAS, and they're developing curriculums for this. Now, with respect to getting started in apologetics, just here in your church, I see you've got some excellent books. This book is a great introduction to apologetics. Before you start doing apologetics, read something like this. J.P. Moreland's Love God With All Your Mind. This book had a profound impact on me. It will inspire you. It talks about the condition of the Christian mind. You have that in the library here, so you might want to book that out. I spoke about hope on Saturday night. Our hope is found in the promises of the Lord, in His existence, but also it's magnified in Jesus' death and resurrection. This is an outstanding book on the resurrection by two experts on the resurrection, Dr. Gary Habermas and Dr. Michael Icona. Okay. Dr. Habermas will be speaking at our conference this year as well. I actually have worked with both of these gentlemen and arranged for Dr. Icona and Dr. Craig to debate some skeptics in South Africa. This book, Tactics, is a very helpful book on evangelism, written by Greg Kokel. Okay. This gets into the nuts and bolts of when you're having a conversation with somebody and they ask a certain question, what do I say in response? Excellent book to help you with personal evangelism. I really, really recommend this book here. And one of the best introductions to apologetics is this book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, written by Dr. Norman Geiser and Frank Turek. And this goes through the basic points and lays it out in 12 ways. So, for example, in our introduction to apologetics at the seminary, one of our classes in introduction to apologetics follows this format. Okay? It just gets a lot more information to it. But an excellent beginning text to have on apologetics. Let me maybe wrap up now with just a story that might inspire you and tell you how this has actually worked in my life. So I was in South Africa with at home with my mother-in-law and my father-in-law on a Sunday reading the Sunday newspaper, and I came across this article in which there was this local liberal scholar. This is South African liberal scholars who started this movement in South Africa called Die Nuwe Hervorming, which in Afrikaans means the New Reformation, which basically distilled and summarized as anything that Orthodox Christianity teaches is false and everything else is more plausible. Okay? That's basically what it is. So, of course, the Eastern religions are just marvelous, but anything about Orthodox Christianity is false. Well, that's nothing new to the Americans, and so, but to the South Africans, they haven't come across some of this stuff. So he writes this really bad article in the newspaper, and then there's two local pastors who respond to this guy. And the worst thing about this reading of the paper was that the responses from the pastors to this guy were worse than this bad article. And I was visibly distraught by this. And then my mother-in-law says this, "Well, why don't you do something about it?" Don't you hate that? With knowledge comes responsibility, hey? And I'm not, my Afrikaans isn't particularly good, and so I wouldn't try and write a response in Afrikaans. I'd leave it to my wife. She's Afrikaans, and she can do a much better job than me on that. So I said, okay, I can't do that. But I've got this friend of mine in South Africa who's got a knack of convincing people to do things that they don't want to do. So I said to this friend of mine, Johan, I said, get in touch with these chaps. They have such a loud voice, and they got such a megaphone, and they've got the complete control of the media, and the papers love them because they're so controversial. And a lot of people in the church, they're not quite sure. They're a Christian, but they're not quite sure. They know that there's something wrong, but they can't quite put their finger on it. And because they're writing these articles, and people are saying, well, there was just something about that article. I couldn't quite. It seemed like there was something wrong. I said, yeah, you were onto something. There's something wrong here. Here's where it's wrong. Ah, I see it now. And so a lot of people were sharing this. And I thought, you know, it's long overdue that these guys are challenged by somebody. Okay? And here's what the Lord did. It's a pretty awesome story. So, this guy goes and speaks to me. He says, yeah, I'd love to debate you. So I said to this guy, you get him to the debate table. I will go to America and find somebody to debate. So who did I phone up? I phoned up William Lane Craig. And 3 months later, he said, yes, I'll do this for you. I nearly fell off my chair when he said yes. So I had this guy working with me. These guys had no idea what was coming their way. And what made matters worse is he then challenged us to a 2-versus-2 debate. He said to me, I want to do this debate with a friend of mine. And I went to Dr. Craig and I said, Dr. Craig, are you interested in... He said, Simon, typically I don't like to debate with another because debates are pretty technical for me. And he said to him, but if I was to debate with another person, I would want to debate with a guy by the name of Michael Akona, this chap here, who's an expert on the resurrection and the early church. Well, what did I do? I phoned Michael Akona up and I knew him. And I said, hey, Mike, would you be interested in doing this? He said, Simon, I've got all these writing deadlines. I can't make it and everything. I said, no, that's fine. That's fine. Well, 2 weeks later, he gives me a call. He says, look, man, I'm in. So now I've got Mike Lacona teaming up with Dr. William Lane Craig. And they live next door to each other in Atlanta. So they start preparing months in advance for this thing. These guys in South Africa are just there. They're so used to just bulldozing everybody and getting their way. We show up at the University of Pretoria on the evening of the debate. We had asked to have a bigger auditorium because we could tell that there was going to be a large audience there. The auditorium we had could seat about 700. On the day of the debate, we realized there was going to be a problem. They wouldn't give us a large auditorium, so we arranged on the debate to get this guy to come in and put up cameras and stream the event to this outside sort of auditorium. Okay? So we had the event being streamed out live in the middle of winter in South Africa. And I don't think that Africa is just about, you know, African sunshine and hot weather. There's parts of Africa that get snow, and on the Highveld, which is very, very high, and there's mountains in South Africa, which are 16,000 feet, when you're on the plateau, it gets really cold there. It's below zero. These people are sitting outside, and it's freezing. Well, these guys didn't expect more than 150 people to show up. 1,200 people show up at their debate. And these guys show up there, and Dr. Craig and Dr. Lacona put them to the sword in front of everybody in a public debate. To the point where I began to feel sorry for these guys. Yeah. It was uncomfortable. I mean, I really, they literally just, because they just assumed that we Christians, you know, we don't have anything meaningful to say to them. And they got completely and utterly dismantled. You know, I mean, I don't do this just to sort of, you know, poke them in the eye and make fun of them. I do this because I want these men to know that their ideas about Jesus are false. But when they stand up and they start bullying young people and saying these things, because they've got the PhDs from the universities, and a lot of people don't know how to respond to them. But when they were on the public platform alongside another Christian scholar who also has a PhD and is not intimidated by academic credentials and has read as much as they've read, if not more, it changes the nature of the discussion. If you get a chance, look at the debate online between Dr. John Lennox and Richard Dawkins, the world's leading atheist. You'll be encouraged by watching how John Lennox handles Richard Dawkins. Now, when Richard Dawkins goes down to Alabama and he finds a couple of people from a local Baptist church, he picks on them and he makes them look like fools. And yeah, but we could send Dr. Lennox to go to a couple of armchair atheists and make them look like fools as well. But that's not what this is about. What we're about here is trying to represent the positions as strong as they can be and make our strongest case. And so this is something which we can all be involved in. I've seen the Lord do this through my life, and I'm working for an institution now that wants to help churches. And so I'm praying that this church might be a catalyst for this area, encouraging other churches to integrate apologetics, and we can come alongside you and bring these people in here. And I know most of these people personally. And then in the future, you won't have to have me up here rambling on about God and science. I can actually send you some scientists, you know, and send you people who have a PhD on the resurrection to encourage you and to equip you. You know, that would just be awesome for the Lord to do that. And so I'm praying and hoping that what we've done here this weekend is we've said enough to encourage you all. And I'm sure that some of you have thought, man, my brain is really hurting. Part of the reason why I'm bald is because of apologetics. Because I'm always thinking, geez, what is that? You know, that's why I'm bald, you know? I think. I hope, maybe. But I just want to say on behalf of my wife and myself, just thank you so much for an amazing weekend. You people have been wonderful, and it's been a real privilege.